Hey, I'm Robbie Kramer. You're listening to the Leverage Podcast, where we discuss using your social skills to hack dating, travel, finding your dream job, and becoming a complete man.
Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Leverage Podcast. We've got a really good buddy of mine who's also a tribe leader in the Leverage Group. By tribe leader, I guess you could just call that he's kind of a big deal within the group.
Glad somebody thinks that.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking about a whole bunch of stuff today. A lot on persuasion and just getting people to say yes to your invitations. But I don't want to spoil it. So, Nick, welcome to the show, and tell us what we're going to talk about.
Well, thanks, Robbie. I'm really excited to be here. And what we're going to talk about today is essentially my interpretation of two books. One book was written by a guy named Jim Camp called Start With No. And then another one is a book by a guy named Chris Voss, who wrote a book called Never Split the Difference. And Chris Voss was a FBI hostage negotiator. In fact, he was a big deal. He was the guy that trained the people. And most of what I want to talk about is out of the Chris Voss book. And so why would you have me on the podcast? I didn't write these books. I didn't create this material. But my story is that I'm a chiropractor. It's like, well, as a chiropractor on here talking about somebody else's books, I've been practicing for about 18 years. And when I got out of school, I was from a really technical end of spinal rehabilitation. And I was so excited to get out in the field and work. And I had all this research and data and reasons logically why I am the best guy for you for care. And what I found for the first really 3 to 5 years was a lot of frustration because I didn't know what I didn't know, which is people are not motivated by logic, facts, and research. We make decisions based on emotion and we justify them later with facts. So I was hammering people with research and data and facts, and it just fell on deaf ears because they weren't compelled emotionally to make a decision. And so in my time as a practicing spine guy, I've probably had, if I do the extrapolatory math, about 100,000 or more interactions, personal one-on-one interactions with patients. What that's allowed me to do is very quickly, first of all, I realized that I was as much of a counselor and a psychologist to my patients as I was their spine doctor. And so right. All that face time has allowed me a lot of experience with reading people, talking to people, listening to people, and trying things that didn't work. The typical traps that we go down, meaning the yes thing, right? We're all hooked on yes. And so that's why I'm so excited about this, because it's all about getting people to say no, which feels counterintuitive, but is incredibly effective.
Yeah, I read the books about, I want to say around two and a half years ago, and they had an immediate impact. And I started implementing some of the advice and had some very fast results. At the time, I was doing a lot of sales and marketing and was really helping. And then about 6 months later, I, you know, kind of went in a slightly different direction and did way fewer sales. And I don't think I really got a chance to ingrain some of the teachings. And then when you told me that you had, you know, gone through those books, it was like the light bulb went off. I was like, oh my God, I've been forgetting these amazing, what do you call them? Distinctions, basically. And then we started talking about it and how you can apply it to all different sorts of areas, not, you know, sales, persuasion, dating, you name it.
Well, when we talk about no versus yes, and when you start trying to phrase questions to get a no, you realize it's a little tricky because we're so addicted to yes. I mean, mm-hmm. How many times do people just automatically say yes to things and they're not even really listening? And we want to say yes and we want to get other people to yes. But the dark side of yes is that people can feel that in a lot of yeses, there's a fishing hook, there's a trap. And even though you can easily compel people down this road to saying a bunch of yeses, there's a bunch of layers there, and yeses don't always mean yes, because yes is nothing without how, right? I mean, people can agree to something. It's like we've talked about pity numbers. You approach a girl, you get a pity number, or you get her to agree to go on a date, and then she says yes, but nothing ever happens, right? It's
yeah,
it's
she counterfeit flakes.
Yes.
Right.
She flakes because it wasn't really a yes. She just, there's a lot of reasons we say yes to people, and they're not always to genuinely implement going forward with whatever the plan is.
You know, the I'm sure you've heard of a yes ladder in sales and marketing before, right? I think that, like, I remember reading about that way back when I started studying sales and thinking, this is so, just so like lame, and how could that really work? Yeah, I was like, that's not gonna work. I don't think it really works. The people pushing it, you know, try to say they work. The worst is like those old speed seduction idiots try to use this in dating, where you're like, you know, you go up to a girl and you get her to say yes to like five or stupid things, like, you know, do you like ice cream? Yeah, right. And then you switch. How about you come out and get naked with me? Oh, well, yeah, I just said yeah to the ice cream, so count me in. It's like, come on. That shit is just so fucking terrible from back in the day.
Well, that started with a book written in 1981 called Getting to Yes. And that book is really logically sound. I mean, logically it makes sense, but it neglects the fact that we're not logical decision makers. We're emotional decision makers. And people want to be understood and accepted, but people need to feel safe and secure. And yes takes away that security. And no is security. As an analytical guy, like you and like a lot of our tribesmen, I really like the science behind things. And if you think about, I mean, many of the things that we've talked about are rooted in evolutionary biology and our survival drive. And if you think about the part of the brain called the amygdala means almond in Latin, because it's an almond-shaped organ. We actually have two of them, one on each side of the brain. And the amygdala is basically, it's got four times as much tissue area for processing the negative things as it does the positive. And the reason is because, again, it's driven for our survival. An example of that would be, say you, and it's automatic, like say you're walking through the grass and a snake jumps out at you. Well, you don't have to think about getting away from the snake. Your amygdala just says, well, get away from the snake. Mm-hmm. And so, or say you get bit by a dog, right? And then a year later, you see a dog that looks just like the dog that bit you. Well, immediately these involuntary feelings of apprehension and fear all come up because your amygdala is trying to protect you. But what we can do with the amygdala is, when we address the negatives and the barriers, it actually does something where it changes the wiring and it frees up space for the positives. So we can get
so I understand, it has four times the processing power for negatives as positives, or the other way around?
Correct.
So it's basically designed it's survival. It's your reptilian brain, they say, maybe, that is supposed to fight or flight, freeze. That's the amygdala we're talking.
Fight, flight, make friends is the states that we have. And in with the flight is also, like you said, the freeze. Mm-hmm. If you're, say, walking through the woods and you hear something that startles you, you don't immediately break into a run or put up your fists. First thing you do is you stop. Like, what's that?
Right.
Have you ever seen the movie Free Solo, about the guy that climbs El Capitan?
I saw the trailers for it. I might have seen it. I don't think I saw it, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
This guy climbs a part of El Capitan that's a 3,000-foot vertical wall with no ropes. Mm-hmm. And so he's being examined by a neurologist, and they do, I believe, an fMRI on him. And the doctor, she says, see, on this side, this is an amygdala firing in a normal person when we show them scary images. It's all lit up like a Christmas tree. And she says, and then over here, here's your amygdala when we show you startling images. It's black. It doesn't do anything. So this guy, whether he trained his amygdala to reject that stuff or he was born with some developmental difference, because he's obviously, you got to be a different kind of guy to climb 3,000 feet with basically nothing to hold on to and no ropes. I mean, it's the movie's terrifying. Yeah. Like, even though you know he's not going to fall, you still are scared to watch it.
I don't think I saw it. I'm sure I didn't see it, but I remember having quite the reaction just from seeing the trailer.
Oh man, like, bonkers. Yeah.
So that's crazy. Did he train his brain to for that, or he was just born like that, do you think? They don't know.
They don't know. I mean, it's maybe a combination of both. The guy's done so many scary things, you can see how the feedback from his amygdala might be blunted, but it's startling. I mean, you almost think that maybe there's some, the guy's kind of, he seems a bit autistic maybe. So maybe there's a tie in there.
Yeah. Was there some storyline as well with his girlfriend?
Yeah. So he processes a lot of things differently. Like his girlfriend essentially had to train him. She would say, "I love you." And he would say initially, "Well, I appreciate you very much as well. And thank you for saying that." And she'd say, "No, now you say, I love you too. And mean it." He just wasn't wired like that. He's a strange guy.
Yeah. Shit. Sounds like a tough relationship for her.
I don't see it going like super long. So back to yes, right? The dark side of yes. Yes, we know it can be a trap, and there's three different kinds of yes. There's the counterfeit yes, which is you get somebody to agree to something, but they agree to it just because they want you to leave them alone. Okay, fine. Yes, sure, I'll do it. And then there's a confirmation yes, which is a little better, but it doesn't necessarily lead to action. And then there's a commitment yes. And so these are really important distinctions and great reasons to get more away from using yes and more to using no.
What were the three? It was the counterfeit and what was the second one?
Confirmation.
Mm-hmm.
Confirmation and commitment. And the commitment's the real deal, yes. And on the other end, the counterfeit is the phony.
Should we do some, I mean, the obvious example for a counterfeit, you know, that we see all the time from guys going through the leverage program and approaching women is you get a ton of counterfeit yeses when, you know, it's like, if you want to learn what a counterfeit yes is, you know, approach some women, be straightforward, and you'll see how that goes. Anything from a phone number to, you know, Instagram to, you know, and guys will say all the time, "I got her number." And it's like, well, it's a counterfeit number, right? Or I texted her and she seemed really interested when, you know, when she gave me her Instagram and I messaged her on Instagram and then she just never responded. Like that was a counterfeit yes. I'm sure in sales and marketing that happens all the time. Would you get that quite a bit with your patients when you were, you know, whatever, trying to sell them on some sort of treatment?
It's funny you ask that. Yeah, I've actually had a pretty hard smack in the face with the yes thing. I've used a number of different coaches for chiropractic and business, and one of the coaching systems I used was built on NLP and that yes ladder and all that stuff. And it was a very scripted thing that logically made sense. And it's coming from a good place. I wasn't trying to talk anybody into something they didn't need. I was simply trying to lead people to the conclusion that's best for them when I'm sure that I can help them. So I'm actually going through a situation right now that's a backlash from all this yes stuff. So what happened was I treated a woman who's probably 60 and she's very happy with her care. And she had gone almost all the way through care and then she referred her daughter in, and the daughter went through the same process, and the daughter had some friction from her husband from the get-go, but she told her husband, "I don't care what you say, I'm doing this anyway." And I thought at the time, good for her, you know, being her own woman. Well, what happened was probably from negative talk from her husband, combined with she may not have been getting the results that she wanted. She never said anything to me, but clearly she and her mother later accused me of sort of using pain to get people into care and sort of taking advantage of them. And I was really surprised because her mother was totally stoked with her results, but then she had gotten flipped. And as you know, people are bad with direct conflict and resolving conflicts. And so rather than just come talk to me and say, hey, I'm not happy for whatever reason, in which case I would have said, I will do whatever it takes to do right by you, whatever that means. She didn't do that. She and her mother both anonymously filed a complaint against me with a large insurance company. And as we speak, I'm being audited by this company to check for my billing practices and my note-taking. And basically what they're looking to do is they're looking to take money back from me after the fact. So it was really disappointing because it's annoying, it's stressful. It kind of bums you out because it's like, why couldn't we just talk like people rather than this, you know, behind the scenes, I'm going to get you thing, when it all could have been easily resolved with some communication, which is what the no thing is great about is it opens up communication. It's really meant to get more information and truly understand where the other person is coming from. Because when we get to know, it no doesn't mean no forever. No means I'm not ready yet. I need more information. I don't understand. Things along those lines. No is really a good thing. The other thing that you find with no is how people very often just don't listen. People are just sort of on this autopilot. Yes, yes, yes. In fact, I've had it where I've done these no things with people and patients, and it's the question is set up for a no, but they'll go just autopilot. Yes. And I'll go, yes. And then they go, they snap out of it and they realize, oh, I'm not listening. So it's cool because it re-engages them and they pay more attention because they've been caught not listening.
Got it. So yeah, let's talk about some examples where we want someone to get to know first and how do we do it?
Okay. Well,
or if there's anything else we need to understand leading up to that.
So it's sort of situationally dependent. Like, I mean, a cheesy and easy example I could give would be, say, in my world. Hey, Robbie, would you like to get rid of your headaches? Right? You've come to me with headaches. Instead, I could say, hey, Robbie, have you given up on being headache free? It's a much different question. Because it opens up all kinds of things. If you say, yes, I've given up on it, well, that's good to know. And that opens up a whole dialogue of what we need to know. But if you say, yes, I've given up. But if you say, no, I haven't given up, great. We're into a constructive conversation.
Totally.
So I'll use it in just to try to use no. I'll ask questions that are kind of silly, say at the coffee shop, just to get in the practice of it. I'll say, rather than, could I have a quad cappuccino? It's like, sure, of course you can. But instead I'll say, is it crazy for me to get a quad cappuccino? And they'll go, they might go, well, that's a lot of caffeine, but yeah, here you go. Right? So just practice. And it feels a little weird at first, but it's just like you talked about. You read the book and then we can easily forget about it. And you sort of don't implement it.
Yeah. Another great example. I don't remember if you told me this or it was in the book, but when he asked to sit in an area of a restaurant, or someone asked to sit in an area of a restaurant that was closed, and how was that framed?
Yeah. So the scenario was they were in a busy restaurant at happy hour, and all they wanted to do after this meeting was have a happy hour drink, and so there was. All the seats were taken except for this roped off area. And rather than say, is it okay if we sit here? He asked the server, would it be horrible if we sat here? We just want a drink. And she goes, no, that's fine. As long as you're out of here by 6 dinner time.
Yeah.
So, and I've used that would it be horrible thing in scenarios like that. And it works great because it makes them think about it a little bit.
Yeah.
And say, well, it's not horrible, right? Mm-hmm. You can do it for now. There's framing phrases like, you brought up one as far as an approach. Is it too forward, right? Is it too forward for a guy to see a lady walking down the street and run up to her and say, hey, my name's Nick, right? I've not used that specifically, but it's really good, right? Because she gets the right to say, yeah, it's horrible, or no, it's not horrible. You can say things like, am I out of line to whatever? Have you given up on whatever? Are you against whatever? A great one that I love is if I wanted to talk to somebody, rather than say to them like we often say, do you have a minute to talk? That's a terrible question because in your mind, you're going, well, what's a minute, first of all? If I do agree to talk to you for a minute, do I want to talk about what you want to talk about? And how can I get out of this conversation when I want to? Instead, great thing to say is now a bad time to talk? It works amazing.
Yeah, that's great.
Because if you say, yeah, now's a bad time to talk, you can say, okay, well, when's a good time to talk?
Yeah, just that little thing alone, just starting a conversation with that could change everything. You know, especially because I think the hardest thing if we're talking about like an approach, like if you get a girl to stop, right, and she's stopping just to be polite, that is never, it's never going to result in a connection, you know, because she's basically just like, all right, I'm going to be polite. I'm going to let this guy kind of run through his spiel here. And I'm going to be on my way as fast as possible. There's no opening for a connection to happen because she's basically already said no with a counterfeit yes, right? Same thing for, I get those people who, you know, they're out on the street with a clipboard trying to get signatures or trying to get donations. You know, I'll stop for them for a second because I'm, you know, sometimes I'm too nice of a guy, you know, too much of a pussy to just say, fuck off, don't talk to me. Right. Yeah. Or they'll use some, they're like, oh, can I pet your dog? And I'm like, oh, okay. You know, so yes. they
get me that. To.
Right. And I know that they're just doing it to, you know, to then weave into the whatever break sales the thing ice. Is coming. Right. They can, you know, the dog's an easy angle. Right. It's like the guys that hit on a girl by like going up and asking about the dog, but the girl knows it's coming. And it's like, you know, you don't get it. That never works, right? To go that dog angle. I'm completely closed to whatever they're selling immediately. But if they were to use what you suggested, you know, I might be way more open to it.
Yeah, but when you have the right of refusal, it offers protection. It offers safety. I mean, if you think about, you've been around little kids. I mean, I don't know the stats on it, but I bet you money when you hear little kids, one of their first words that little kids learn is no. They learn how to say no really quickly for protection. No, no, no.
Yeah, that's true.
I bet you it's one of the first, if not maybe the first word that most little kids learn because it says a lot. Mm-hmm.
Is that something that they teach on purpose or that's just the basic, you know, parents making sure their kids, you know, say no to strangers or.
I don't think so. I mean, this is my interpretation of it. This is not stuff that's in the book. I was just in thinking about it. I was thinking, how often have you seen a kid who basically can't talk, but they know one or two words like mom, but they definitely know no.
Yeah.
This could definitely be used in approaching, which I know like a lot of the guys listening to this podcast are going to be really interested in. And what I didn't want to do was write a bunch of canned sort of approach lines. Cause I'd like the listeners to utilize these sort of these pre-framing phrases, like, is it too forward, to form their own personal approach to it. And like we've talked about, or like you've taught us, I should say, the very first thing is you have to commit and you have to get them to stop. Because when you think about a woman who's a foot shorter than you and 100 pounds lighter, it's that amygdala thing. Some strange guy stops her in the street. The first thing she's doing is assessing her safety and going like, what does this guy want? What's going on here? So you have to break past the barrier of where she's just alarmed and then get to the, is it too forward? Right.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love the guys to go out there and use that. And you came up with the, is it too forward thing? And I think it's really good. And I think it could be really useful.
Yeah, that one would be cool. The other one that immediately comes to my head, would it be like totally weird if, you know, I hit on you in line at the Starbucks, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's so many options with it, and I think it's much more disarming.
And I know when I was just kind of first getting into, you know, approaching women without drinks, without being drunk, you know, in a non-social environment. So on the street, at a Starbucks, you know, in the library, wherever it was terrifying for me to do it. But when I had something that I knew I could say that was really authentic and that made me, you know, made me a little bit excited to say it, that was a total game changer for me. And I don't know if that's true for everyone. I know it's for a lot of people I talk to, a lot of guys I coach, you know, everyone's, a lot of their first thing is like, well, I don't know what to say. And when you don't have that objection in your brain and you have something that you actually are excited to say that you want to try out, I think that can be a huge, you know, the difference between doing it and not doing it and doing it and having fun and creating a connection versus just, you know, total getting rejected all the time.
Well, authenticity is everything. I mean, unless you're a sociopath, you're not going to feel comfortable saying something that feels inauthentic or made up. And so I think that's hugely important. And most of the guys who are attracted to being their best selves are going to be analytical guys. And I think sometimes guys get hung up on the magic line, like, how did you say that exactly? Like, what's the line? And then all the things that you talk about, you know, when you get in your head and you're not paying attention to the other person, you're not watching their cues, you're simply thinking about, well, then if she says this, I got to say that, when that's just not the case. We both read the book, What Everybody Is Saying by Joe Navarro. Mm-hmm. Great book. But I've had conversations with guys about the technical aspects. When they do this, it's steepling. When they do that, and what my point on it to them sometimes is, it doesn't matter what you call it. We can all read cues if we just get in the moment and just pay attention. You can tell when people are open, are closed, are nervous, are cautious, are scared. It's really pretty obvious because we're wired to pick it up.
We have the, you know, we have the start with the no. Were there any other teachings beyond that that we can apply this to that really stood out?
When you think about these books are both designed around negotiation. Hostage negotiation, Jim Camp's book is business negotiation. And so you think, well, this stuff that we're talking about isn't really negotiation. But when I was thinking about the definition of the word negotiate, there's two definitions to negotiate. Negotiate, and I'm paraphrasing, right? I might be a little off, but negotiate, first definition is for two or more parties to arrive at a decision mutually using words, right? We would think about a business negotiation like that. But the second definition of negotiate is to find your way around or through an obstacle or difficult path. And so that's really applicable for this conversation, because there was a situation when we were at the immersion, which I told you about at a nightclub, which I utilized these techniques for negotiating a difficult situation. And we use a thing called tactical empathy. And tactical empathy is when you're you imagine yourself in the other person's shoes, you recognize and vocalize their perspective, you understand what's driving their feelings, and you identify emotional obstacles that are getting in the way. And of course, you analyze their words, tone, and body language and make sure that it's congruent. And so the situation that happened, and there's a guy out there that may listen to this podcast who will know who he is. I won't name him, but it was a really salient sort of application of this stuff. So for those of you that weren't there, we were at a nightclub and we were just nightclubbing it. And this guy became really upset. He had an interaction with a girl that didn't go well, and she got upset and he got really upset, and he stormed off. And so he's a buddy. So I didn't want him to be just so darn inconsolably upset. So I followed him, and I stopped him, and I said, "Hey, bud, it seems like you're really upset." And he screamed in my face about this far away, "Why does it seem like I'm upset?" And I said, "Well," in my late night DJ voice, I said, "Well, it seems like you're upset because you stormed off, and because you just screamed in my face." And so I said, "That's why it seems like you're upset." And he said, "Well, I'm upset because I'm putting out a lot of effort and in trying to talk to girls, and I'm not getting, it's not going how I want it to go." And so all I did was I mirrored him. I simply said right back to him what he said. I said, "You're upset because you're really trying hard and you're putting yourself out there and you're not getting the love you want." And he said, "Yeah." And then he went deeper and he said, "Well, I'm upset because of this other reason too." And I just did the same thing. I mirrored him and I said, "You're upset because of blah, blah, blah." And the cool thing about that is this guy was hopping mad, really, really mad. But as we got down this pathway of this tactical empathy and this summarizing his feelings, people that are upset typically really want to know that they're heard first and foremost. And that really diffused a bomb, if you will, diffused his being really, really upset and brought him back to earth and sort of reason re-entered the conversation and really salvaged, I would say, his night, or at least helped it a lot. Because it's funny how people, you say what you think you mean, but people hear what they hear. And he later came up to me and he said, "Well, I wasn't mad, I was just upset." And mad was never used, upset was, but it didn't matter because it got him talking, and then he was tuned back in. So it was really cool.
Yeah, I mean, the application for that, I could probably use that on a daily basis. I tend to upset girls I date on a pretty regular, often with some of my choices.
Here's what you do. When doing these things and labeling their feelings, we don't want to use I, right? We want to use it. So it seems like you're upset. It sounds like you're really passionate. It looks like you feel you're heading in the wrong direction. It feels like. And by doing that, I mean, if we say, "I can tell that you're upset." Well, first of all, when you say that, you're making it about you. And they might say, "Well, you're wrong. I'm not upset. I'm mad." But that's a crucial part, because the cool thing about it, when you label their feelings and say things, "It seems like you're upset," or "It seems like something has got you upset," you might even be wrong, but that's okay, because they'll say, "Well, I'm not really upset. I'm just this or that." And again, you're just getting information and understanding the person. And it's a really powerful way to diffuse a situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you say it seems like you're upset, or it seems like XYZ. You could use this for other things too, right? It seems like you're sad, or maybe whatever.
Anything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then they basically say, "Yeah." And then where does it go from there? There's a little bit more questioning. Like, when do you know to stop?
So what you can do is you go to the summary where, ideally, if you want to switch somebody's viewpoint, you want to get them to say, that's right. I mean, how many times have you had somebody say, you're right? Well, if you get you're right, you're not doing it right. Because you're right is kind of a counterfeit yes. And you're right, people say that all the time just to get you to leave them alone. But if you get them to a that's right. So going back to that situation, it seems like you're upset. Yeah, I'm upset because I'm out there putting myself out. I'm trying and I'm not getting the results I want. I can imagine how that would be really frustrating. And I'm also upset because I feel like I want to get more one-on-one time with the coaches and I'm not. You're also upset because you want to get more one-on-one time with the coach. So then I summarize, you package it up and you say, to show them that you understand them. So you're upset because you're really passionate about doing, you're really passionate about getting to a point where you're able to connect with girls, but you feel like in this situation, despite all your efforts, that's not really happening. And get them to say, that's right. Once you get them to a that's right, that's the golden thing. And in that situation, I don't know that I got this guy to a that's right, but I got him to at least an implication of, you're not always going to get word for word that's right. They might say you got it, or some strong affirmative like that.
And that's basically when, yeah, that's kind of when you've changed, or you've helped them get out of that emotional mindset. I know he talks about that in terms of hostage negotiation, right? When he gets the person to say that's right, that's kind of when you know, that's when he starts going into a deal. Is that right?
Correct. So I've got another real example that I used where I wasn't trying to diffuse a situation. I was genuinely trying to change someone's behavior. So I think I've told you this story, but how it goes is my dad, myself, my dad's neighbor and my employee, we're all in a shooting league for pistols. And it's four people on a team, and you obviously you want to shoot well because it's a cumulative score, and then you're ranked based on that. Like you, I'm pretty competitive, and I want to do well. So my dad's neighbor shoots a revolver, right? The old style, like wheel gun. And he would insist on shooting the revolver what's called double action. So with the revolver, you can cock it and shoot it, or you can just pull the trigger and shoot it. Well, when you pull the trigger and shoot it, it's not nearly as accurate because there's this long travel of the trigger and it moves the gun. So he's shooting and he shoots these just terrible, terrible scores. And so I went and talked to him. And rather than say, why are you shooting double action, dummy? Which is what I was sort of thinking, right? Like, I said, how'd you shoot, man? He said, terrible. I was like, well, are you shooting as well as you want to shoot? And he said, not at all. Well, I said, are you shooting single or double action? I mean, I knew the answer. I could have probably just said, are you shooting double action? And he said, yep. And so rather than say, why are you shooting double action? I said, well, what do you hope to accomplish by shooting double action? And he said, fun. It's more fun to shoot double action. And it feels like it's kind of cheating to shoot single action. I said, oh, okay. So you feel like it's just less authentic of sort of tactical shooting if you're shooting single action. He said, yeah. Well, then he said, and that opened up the conversation. He said, well, how did Christy shoot? Now, she's my employee. She's a brand new shooter. She outshot him by 100 points that round. I said, she shot a 344 out of 360. He went, what? How did she shoot? How'd she do that? And I said, she shoots single action. So that changed the landscape. And guess what? He's been shooting, he's been practicing single action.
Mm-hmm. Great.
So it went great. Yeah.
It's so funny how people get, stuck on stuff, but just these examples happen all the time. you know? And, you know, you think you could just say, bro, come on. But it's not about that. It's about the authenticity for him and the experience, clearly. But you would never know that if you approached it the other way.
Well, I mean, with guys like you and I mean, you can say to me, dude, what are you doing? Don't do that. Do this. Come on, dummy. And I'd be like, okay, got it. Most people don't have that kind of rapport. And a lot of people are so thin-skinned and can't tolerate that sort of accusatory input that they just completely shut off. And you're going to alienate them and hurt their feelings. And you're really ultimately not going to get what you want.
Right. Yeah, it's like, do you get to be right, or do you actually, you know, get what you want? And so many people, they're stuck being right. However, being right doesn't make you happy, because usually it doesn't change the behavior that you're looking to change.
Absolutely. Being right, who cares? I mean, you can be right and be friendless all day long.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, those are such important examples. So how do you get good at this stuff? Is it just, you know, obviously I read the book and I remember I took some notes and I was implementing it and that was helping, but you know, it didn't really stick as much. What have you done to really get this stuff to stick?
I'm trying to stay obsessed with it, and I am pretty darn into it. And so I try to make every interaction that's possible start with no, trying to get to know as much as possible, even if it feels weird, because it's kind of like any process. It's going to feel weird at first. You're going to kind of go too far, but that's okay. And whenever it's working, because I'll have conversations and I'll ask questions of people, and then I'll realize, nope, I went to yes, but my brain will say, well, here's how you could have said that in a no right away. And so I do that, and then I combine it with the tactical empathy and the process that I spoke about with the tribesmen in the club, where it's really super simple. And the great thing about it that I found right away is it really just opens up the lines of communication. And you know, it's kind of also like we talked about, we want to think about not so much, don't think about the outcome. Think about the process. Think about don't be outcome driven, because then you'll be in your head. Think about, I'm just gathering information. And it's incredible how when you really work to understand people, how things go, the connection just goes so much deeper. And these things are really immediately implementable, because you're not memorizing lines. You're simply mostly just saying back to people what they've said to you. And that really resonates. That triggers mirror neurons in the brain and immediately establishes more of a connection. So use it, right?
Yeah.
It's just like, you gotta go out and try it out and fall on your face a little bit, but you don't fall far with this stuff. I mean, the worst thing that's going to happen is, so what if the coffee girl goes, oh, that's a weird way to ask for a cappuccino. Like, who cares?
Right. So would it be terrible if we gave the listeners your email so they could ask you questions?
Yes, it would be. No, I'm just kidding. No, it wouldn't be terrible. They can definitely ask me questions about it. Really, what I'm just going to say overall is get the damn book and read the book, because you could ask me a ton of questions. I'm happy to answer it, because, of course, we know that when you teach people things, you learn it better yourself. So I'd love to teach it. But mostly I would encourage guys to really onboard this stuff for yourself. Go through it, write it out, make it your own, and feel free to ask me questions about it. It's great stuff.
All right. So I'll put a little link below. You know, so people could, if they feel like doing it, but I wonder if the author has any sort of follow-up stuff.
There's, I think he's written another book, which I don't have, but really what the guys can do is just go to YouTube and just search for Chris Voss, V-O-S-S. He's got probably 10 easily referenceable blips on YouTube. There's Google Talks, there's like kind of a TED style talk, and he talks about this information with real examples. And I've listened to all of them multiple times because every time I do, I get a little nugget out of it more. And he's an interesting guy, and you realize the subtlety behind this approach, where it's kind of a sleeper approach, and it doesn't feel manipulative. It feels really genuine because it is really genuine.
Yeah, it really is. Well, dude, you've done such a good job, you know, being able to package all this together and explain it in a real world example, and lots of real world examples. Appreciate you coming on and sharing this awesome wisdom with everyone, because I read the book, obviously, and that wasn't enough to get me. And now I'm totally inspired to like really revisit it, because it's so applicable and useful. So,
well,
thanks
and,
so much.
And going forward, yeah, man, thanks for having me on. I'm really flattered. I'm really grateful to be here. And I want to thank you. I mean, I thank you privately, but I want to thank you publicly for what your life's mission is. And you, the exercises and the reflection that I've been through while I've known you have been some of the most difficult and bracing things that I've ever had to face in my life. And also the most important, because trying to be your best self, especially when centered around like interacting and dealing with women better, brings all of your deepest, darkest shit out. And if you don't face it, you go down the road of a lot of guys. I mean, there's a Jordan Peterson talks about low status males and how common it is for men to remain low status males, meaning guys that never reproduce. Whereas it's really rare for women to remain low enough status females that no one will reproduce with them. And I really think a lot of the anger problems and maybe the outbursts of even violence. Well, we know that it's true. These outbursts of violence and these guys that hurt people over their frustrations and their inability to articulate themselves. And probably one of the most important things for a man, which is to feel important enough for women to consider carrying your genetic material so you can live on. And so thank you for doing this for all of us guys. You're a great coach, and you've got saintly patience.
Thanks, man. No, I love it. And I really appreciate that acknowledgement. That means a lot.
Thanks for listening. If you want more, go to innerconfidence.com, and don't forget to subscribe to this podcast for the latest episodes.